As you can see here, as a special favour to the students enrolled in this class, the lectures, both those that have been given since the beginning of the semester, and those that will be, inshallah, given until the end of the semester, are actually available online. Now, this information was not publicised earlier in order not to encourage consistent absence from the class. But no doubt, you know, my magnetic presence alone is enough to ensure regular attendance on the part of most of you, so it's probably safe to release this information now. But you will probably find it useful, I hope, at least when it comes to reviewing the contents of the course at the very end of the semester. Let's begin with a few supplementary notes on the topic that we discussed last time. The meaning of the greater occultation, the purpose that an occulted imam may be said to fulfill, and certain peripheral modes of communication with the imam, even during the period of the greater occultation. With respect to the first, the purpose of the imam, maybe that wasn't the first anyhow, one of the topics with respect to one of them, the purpose of the imam, what purpose does he fulfill during the greater occultation? Two metaphors are commonly adduced in explanation and the justification of the greater occultation. In the first and most common of them, it is said that the imam in his occultation is like the sun obscured by the clouds. In other words, the sun is most certainly there, although you cannot see it. And not only it is there, but it continues to fulfill its function of giving light and heat, even though it is not immediately visible because of being covered by the clouds. And therefore, to continue the metaphor, the re-emergence of the imam from occultation, which will be our main topic today, will be like the clouds being dispersed from in front of the sun, so that then the sun shines in its full and visible brilliance. Another metaphor that is adduced is that of the heart within the body. Now, clearly, the heart is not visible to us, but we know that the heart is there, and not only is it there despite its invisibility under normal circumstances, but it also fulfills a vital and important function, giving life to the entire human organism. This second metaphor refers mostly to the role of the imam with respect to the community as a whole. That is, that the imam, even in his occultation, is like the heart in the body of the Shia community, giving life and coherence to it, despite his absence from immediate view. So these two metaphors have a certain utility, although like any other metaphor, they are not analytically precise and do not exhaust the topic of the function of the imam. Then the question of peripheral, occasional communication with the imam, even during his occultation. There are a number of items to be listed here. Firstly, the regular reappearance of the imam on the occasion of the Hajj. Remember that this was one feature already during the lesser occultation. The imam, being resident, it was generally held in the Hijaz, would appear and make himself known to a limited number of his followers during the Hajj. And it is likewise said that even today, during the period of the greater occultation, he appears in similar fashion and makes himself known on the occasion of the pilgrimage. And one hears numerous accounts from individuals who claim to have been allotted this particular privilege. Then, in a more formal sense, it is said that if a group of legal scholars of authoritative legal scholars, Fokker has used the technical term, come together and agree upon the subject. That means that the Imam is present among them, in a certain indefinable sense. This is a contention more easily capable of proof, in that the general principles of each man, consensus, has a particular understanding and interpretation which he is. The principle of each man, which we can translate as consensus, is of course a principle of all schools of Islamic law, Sunni as well as Shi'i. In other words, if there is a consensus on a given topic, then that consensus necessarily produces a correct answer. The question, of course, is what individuals must necessarily be involved. What group of people have to agree in order to produce an authoritative consensus? And there are many answers given to this, and the difference is not to be coordinated necessarily with the difference of opinion of Sunnis and Shia. In other words, in Sunni belief also, there are varying understandings of what constitutes each man. However, there is a distinctive Shi'i understanding of each man that it must be the opinion which is endorsed by the Imam himself, which might appear under normal circumstances to negate the whole concept, because even in the absence of a collective agreement on a given topic by the Fuqaha, clearly the opinion of the Imam in isolation is in itself authoritative and decisive. But if one considers the particular circumstances of the greater occultation, then this principle of ijma acquires meaning and practical effect. It means that if the scholars, a group of authoritative scholars, come to agree upon a certain topic, they attain consensus, then by definition that is also the opinion of the Imam, even though there is no claim to communication, even a miraculous communication with the Imam on this particular occasion. To return to the realm of the miraculous or the paranormal, it is said that sometimes, even in the conditions of the greater occultation, there will be the receipt of a written communication from the Imam. Here, the Arabic term is different. Remember, in the lesser occultation, the term given to a the name given to a written communication from the Imam to one of his main agents is Tawqif. The name given to such a communication during the greater occultation is Ruq'ah, which simply means a writing, an inscription in Arabic, a piece of paper. And the Ruq'ah is said generally to be found in a remote location, minimizing the possibility that it should have been, as it were, forged and put there by somebody else, or floating on water. And conversely, the believer may himself initiate written communication with the Imam by writing a petition.
The common word in Arabic for a petition.
And then the response to the ariza, to the petition, might conceivably be received in a ruqah, but more likely through some other indication, some form of inspiration, some sudden realization that a given course of action under consideration is a correct one, or possibly a dream. Dreams of the 12th Imam of the Mahdi during his occultation, during his greater occultation, are a fairly frequent feature of the biographical literature of the Shia scholars. The dream will not necessarily be authoritative for other than the one who sees it. In other words, it is a form of personal communication, a personal favor to the one who sees the 12th Imam in his occultation. But it is said that whoever dreams of the 12th Imam has in fact dreamt of him. In other words, if you wake with a sincere conviction that you have seen the 12th Imam in your dream, then indeed you have. Here we have an analogy with the general principle in Islam, in both Sunni and Shia, that whoever dreams of the Prophet, likewise, has indeed dreamt of him. In other words, it is not possible for another person or entity or force to take on the shape of the Prophet in a dream, thereby deceiving the believer. Therefore, by definition, any dream of the Prophet that is experienced is authentically such. And by analogy, the same applies to the 12th Imam. And then too, there is the possibility, or the actuality, if one accepts numerous narratives to this effect, of having a vision of the Imam, of the 12th Imam, in a waking state, being favored with a vision of him, an actual vision with a physical eye in a waking state. Not on that particular occasion of the Hajj, when he appears in Mecca, but on some other occasion. And numerous are the accounts of scholars of whom it is said that they were in frequent communication with the very person of the 12th Imam by means of this miraculous account. To name one recent report and example, Allama Tabatabai, who died in 1984. Allama Tabatabai, who wrote an extremely important commentary upon the Quran. He is said to have. By those who were closely acquainted with him, including his son, but who have been favored with such regular communication with the 12th Imam. The same also has been said of Imam Khomeini himself. So there are these varying fashions, peripheral, certainly not consistent, and available only to certain individuals, these possibilities of communication even during the period of the 12th Imam occultation. One final note under this heading. Later in this course, in fact towards the very end, I want to talk, however briefly, about the hybrid phenomenon of Sufi Shiism, or Shi'i Sufism, however you would like to term it. Sufism in its major expressions is in sectarian terms a Sunni phenomenon. However, we do have also a few Shi'i groups that are Sufi. Among these groups, there is the belief that their operation, that is the progress of the individual member of the Sufi order, is in some sense takes place under the aegis of the 12th Imam. That although a living individual is the murshid, is the guide on the path, still he acts on behalf of and with the authority of the 12th Imam. It is said that the relationship between the two is the relationship of the sun and the moon. In other words, the true guide is the sun, the Imam. However, his light is, as it were, reflected on the moon, i.e. The person of the sheikh, of the guide, the living guide in the Sufi order. So this also is one mode of communication in the world of Sufi Shiism, or Shi'i Sufism, or however one puts it. Not surprisingly, this interpretation of matters was strongly contested and remains strongly contested by the Shi'i ulama, by the Shi'i religious scholars, who insist upon their own privileged, although selected, function as the as those who exercise on behalf of the Hidden Imam numerous of his powers and functions during the Great Rock occupation. Now let us pass to what we find in the quite abundant literature concerning the anticipated emergence of the 12th Imam at the end of time. Let us remind ourselves that the literature insists upon the fact that the absence, the occultation, the greater occultation, will be of unpredictable length, that the individual believer should not expect the re-emergence of the Imam in his or her own lifetime, but this patience and restraint must go together with an aspiration for the Imam to return. So a combination of opposing or contrasting attitudes, which in itself, the maintenance of these attitudes, one may say also is a certain type of communication with the Imam. In other words, keeping alive the memory of him, being aware of him constantly, is in itself a mode of his presence. If he is present in the mind, if he is present in the heart, this in itself is a certain type function exercised by him. But let us pass now to what is said in the very abundant and detailed literature about the anticipated return of the Imam from occultation. First, let us look at the various terms that are used to designate it. Ghaiba, by now we're all fully familiar with, meaning absence or occultation. There are three words which designate the emergence of the Imam, the ultimate emergence of the Imam from the state of occultation. First, Qiyam, which is obviously, at least I hope obviously, cognate with that title, Qa'im. Remember Qa'im, about which I talked at length? The Imam, the first Imam, is designated as Qa'im, the one who will arise and fulfill expectations of universal justice and the vindication of the Imamate at the end of time. Qa'im is then the personal noun or the adjective. Qiyam is the verbal noun. Qiyam, the rising up. And of course, it has within itself all of the connotations of the word Qa'im. Also, however, it is the word Qiyam is connected not only with the rising of the 12th Imam in order to vindicate the cause of the Imamate and to bring about the universal triumph of justice, it also in a sense announces the proximity of resurrection, and not coincidentally the word for resurrection is in Arabic called Qiyamah. So one can say that the appearance of Qiyam, the rising of the Imam, is an indication that Qiyamah, the resurrection, is near at hand. In fact, the Qiyam is the principal sign of the nearness of the approach of resurrection. And secondly, Zuhur, appearance, pretty obvious. Nothing to be said beyond the obvious literal sense of the word Zuhur. Zuhur, out of a state of occultation, the Imam will come forth and become visible and present. And finally, among these terms, Khuruj. Khuruj meaning literally emergence. And the primary sense of the word is, of course, obvious. He will emerge from the state of invisibility, of occultation, into a state of duhur, of appearance, of manifestation. There is, however, a secondary sense, which is also relevant, In Arabic, the verb haraja, which is a verbal noun, haraja, when construed with the preposition ala, one might translate as come out against. In other words, this has the sense of insurrection, of opposition, of confrontation, and precisely like the corresponding English idiom to come out against someone or something means to stand up in opposition to, in confrontation with. And this also is the sense of the word khuruj when applied to the 12th Imam. His will be the final and triumphant insurrection against injustice and illegitimate rule. So these three words are used and all indicate one dimension or other of that which is anticipated. However, when it comes to the circumstances, the time and the place of the re-emergence, the appearance of the Imam, very many details are to be found, which it is difficult to work into a coherent and consistent whole. This may be, in the nature of things, understandable, comprehensible, precisely because of the mysterious nature of the phenomenon. And I'm using the word mysterious here in the original, not the colloquial sense of the word. In other words, this is a mystery. It is something which, in and of itself, is beyond human comprehension. It is beyond the ordinary sensory experience of man. That being the case, it is comprehensible that there should not be a complete agreement upon all of the narrative details concerning what will ultimately happen. It is, of course, true that most of those details are derived from hadith. But remember that the science of hadith is, even in the hands of its most capable practitioners, a somewhat fragile science, and that in the case of Shia hadith, the factor of taqiyah has always to be borne in mind. That is to say that the imam may, on a given, the imam, in other words, any of the imams, may on a given occasion have deliberately refrained from a presentation of the matter at hand in a way that indeed reflects his view. So what I have attempted to do in discussion that now follows is, as it were, to iron out some of the contradictions, to present the main features, the highlights of what is agreed upon by all of the authorities on this question. In advance of that kind of rationalized summary, there are the following two things to say. Firstly, that as we shall see, many of the details concerning the circumstances of the re-emergence of the Imam, the places where he is active, the personages involved, are clearly derived from the early history of Islam and of Shiism in particular. It is, as it were, they constitute, these details, an echo of what happened in the early history of Islam, which is again entirely comprehensible in that one of the purposes, one of the immediate purposes of the re-emergence of the Imam will be to avenge the injustices suffered in the past by the Ahl Bayt, who, as it were, reversed the course of history. So that some details which might otherwise appear curious are in this sense explicable. And secondly, many of the details obviously have a symbolic significance, connecting the re-emergence of the 12th Imam with the whole pattern of sacred history. In other words, not simply a replay or a revision of events in the early history of Islam, but they connect the 12th Imam and his re-emergence with the whole pattern of sacred history from the very origins of humanity. When I say they have a symbolic significance, I do not mean to say necessarily by this, I'm leaving the question open for present purposes, that such events will not palpably, visibly happen. I'm simply drawing attention to the fact that there is an undeniable symbolic significance attached to many of these events. So to begin with, the question of time. As already mentioned, the time of the re-emergence of the Imam is uncertain, is unknown. And indeed, we have an explicit prohibition of any attempt to predict the coming of the or the return of the Imam al-Mahdi to manifestation. And this for two important reasons. Firstly, because the belief in the re-emergence of the Imam at the end of time is obviously tied to the belief in resurrection. Qiyam is the prelude to Qiyam. And the timing of resurrection is unknown, and in fact we have in the Quran itself a clear and unmistakable statement that the timing of resurrection, when the hour shall come, is known only to Allah. This is to be found in verse 187 of chapter 7, where the Prophet is instructed to say, in answer to those who question him about the coming of the hour of resurrection, say, the knowledge thereof is with my Lord. It is Allah alone who knows when the hour will come. That being the case, an event which is closely associated with and serves as the prelude to the coming of resurrection, it is appropriate that the timing, the precise timing of that, should also be left unknown, and in fact unknowable. The second important reason for this unknowability of the time of the emergence of the Imam is, of course, the continuing danger to which the Shia community was exposed. If, for example, there were a precise prediction of the re-emergence of the Imam, then the enemies of the Shia cause, the enemies of the Imams, obviously will be in a position to make preparations to increase repression and in order to forestall any possible preparation by the followers of the Shia community to lend their support to the Imam once he came. So, in terms of year, there is absolutely no knowledge, nor even the possibility of knowledge. However, the day is, of course, fixed. There is a complete agreement on the day. In just the same way that there is a complete agreement on the day on which the Imam was born, the 15th of the month of Sha'ban. And likewise, the day upon which the Imam will re-emerge is fixed, according to the agreement of all of the relevant traditions, on Ashura, the 10th day of Muharram. And it is here that we come to some of the matters already discussed, i.e., echoes of the early history of Islam and of Shiism in particular, and a connection between the Mahdi and the overall development of sacred history. Because Ashura, as I think I already pointed out, even before the martyrdom of Imam Hussein at Karbala, was a day on which significant events happened in the sacred history of humanity. It was on that day, it is said, that Adam descended to earth. It was on that day that the flood had subsided and Noah descended from the ark. It was on that day that Ibrahim was delivered from the fire, on that day that Jesus ascended to heaven. And in addition to that, before the institution of the month-long fast of Ramadan, there was a one-day fast observed by the early Muslims before the migration to Medina, again on the day of Ashura. So it was a day already replete with these significances and associations. But of course, after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein at Karbala, all of this was overshadowed by precisely that event. So that Ashura, in the memory not only of Shi'i Muslims but also Sunnis, became above all the day on which the grandson of the Prophet had been martyred in that atrocious fashion. So this being the case, that the 12th Imam will reappear on Ashura. Ashura, I can say, is a day not only on which one looks back to and commemorates, remembers the martyrdom of Imam Hussein at Karbala, it is also a day on which one looks forward to the emergence of the 12th Imam. But although this is maybe overshadowed, the latter is overshadowed by the former. Mourning is a more important, or at least a more widely practiced component of devotion on that day than is looking forward to the emergence of the 12th Imam. But it is that also one looks forward in the two senses of that expression. You anticipate it in the future and you look forward to it in the sense of eagerness and happiness. One aspect of this timing is, of course, that among other things, the re-emergence of the Imam out of occultation on that day will accomplish vengeance for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. Then, again with respect to timing, it is said that the first outward sign of the impending re-emergence of the Imam from occultation will be on the night of the 23rd of Ramadan in the preceding year. Remember that Muharram is the first month of the Islamic year. And therefore in advance of that, in the preceding year, on the 23rd night of Ramadan, a sign will be given. Before we discuss the nature and the content of that sign, let us recall also the general significance of the 23rd of Ramadan. The 23rd of Ramadan is that day or night that is generally identified in Shia tradition as being the night of power. The primary significance, or the most common significance of Laylatul Qadr, for the night of power, is that on that night the Quran was revealed in the following sense. It was brought down from the proximity of the divine throne to the edge of the worldly plane as a totality, as a body, and thereafter, piece by piece, it was conveyed to the archangel, by the archangel Gabriel, to the prophet. So one may think in rather crude fashion of revelation of the Quran consisting of these two essential stages. First, as it were, a bringing down of the totality of the book to the proximity of the world, and from there its gradual transference in accordance with circumstances to the prophet by means of the archangel Gabriel. As for the uncertainty or the difference of opinion concerning its time, this goes back to a tradition from the Prophet in which he says, search for the Laylatul Qadr, the night of power, on an odd-numbered night during the last 10 days of Ramadan. Search for the night of power on an odd-numbered night during the last 10 days of Ramadan. So that in theory, the night of power might be as early as the 21st of Ramadan, as late as the 29th. Why the ambiguity? Because it contains an encouragement to observe each of those nights as Laylatul Qadr in order to gain the benefit from doing so. However, generally speaking, attempts have been made to identify Laylatul Qadr with a particular night. In Sunni tradition, most commonly the 27th, in Shia tradition, most commonly the 23rd. So the fact that this, as it were, preliminary announcement of the forthcoming return of the Imam will be made on the 23rd of Ramadan is significant. It was on that night which the Quran as a totality was sent down. And given that essential and unbreakable linkage between the Quran and the Ahl Bayt, which we evoked at the very beginning of this course, it is appropriate that the proclamation of his return should take place on this particular night. In other words, there is a kind of indication by virtue of timing of this important linkage between the last member of the Ahl Bayt and the 12th Imam and the original receipt of revelation. Now, what is the sign that is given on this night? A voice will call out from the heavens that Al-Mahdi Al-Qa'im, Al-Qa'im Al-Mahdi, i.e. the 12th Imam, will re-emerge next Ashura. This preliminary announcement will, however, be audible only to the faithful followers of the Imam. It is not yet a universally audible proclamation of his re-emergence. However, it will be accompanied or quickly followed by signs visible to all. On earth, for example, it is said that the sun will rise in the west, that solar and lunar eclipses will take place in quick succession. So these cosmic signs will also point to the unique nature of the time. They count as an indication that the order of all things, cosmic as well as worldly, is about to be overturned. And some of these signs, I mean these two in particular, the sun rising in the west, and the solar and lunar eclipses to take place in quick succession. These also we find in the Sunni literature concerning the re-emergence. The emergence of the Mahdi. And of course, sometimes one finds attempts being made to give a metaphorical interpretation to these. To these signs, for example, the fact that the sun will rise in the west. We'll find some Muslims saying that, you know, well, this means that the rebirth of Islam will take place right here in the west, in fact the westernmost region of the west, right here in California. But this kind of self-congratulatory metaphorical interpretation cannot really be taken too seriously, quite apart from our state of disarray. There is nothing in the literature to indicate that these signs are other than events that will indeed be visible, observable, with the physical eye in the cosmos. This much concerning time. As far as place is concerned, there is again a total consensus, or maybe we should say a near total consensus, that the place of the re-emergence of the Imam will be in Mecca, as I've already pointed out. He will not re-emerge in any of the places that are more narrowly and more particularly associated with Shiism. Not in Najaf, Karbala, Kufa, Samarra, not even in Medina, but in Mecca. I don't wish to repeat myself, just to remind you that this is because he will be a Mahdi al-Anam. He is a Mahdi sent to humanity as a whole, the Mahdi of mankind. And it is therefore appropriate that he should appear at that place, the Kaaba, which is described in the Quran, to be more precise, in verse 96 of chapter 3 of the Quran, as the first house established for mankind. Now we enter into the realm of precise detail, where it has become necessary to ignore certain inconsistencies and try to construct a consistent narrative. We have a hadith from Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, which says that the Mahdi, the Imam al-Mahdi, will enter Mecca wearing the same clothing that the Prophet wore, and will have on his feet the same sandals that the prophet wore. Whether by same is meant of the same type or substantially the same identical items is left open. Probably it is the latter that is intended. And clearly, without wishing to prejudge one way or another the literal veracity of this prediction, the symbolic sense is clear. That is, the Imam al-Mahdi comes as the successor to the Prophet, as the one who will vindicate the cause of the Imams, whose authority goes back to the Prophet himself. It is also said in the continuation of the same hadith that he will be driving a herd of goats before him so that none will recognize him. So he will drive a herd of goats before him so that none will recognize him. In other words, in advance of his general proclamation, he will assume this lowly guise in order to protect his identity one final time before his open re-emergence and the vindication of the cause. He will, having entered Mecca, go to the courtyard of the Kaaba, courtyard surrounding the Kaaba, and await nightfall. Then, once night falls, he will be visited by two of the archangels, Jibril and Mikael. Jibril, Mikael. And they will promise him their support in the tasks that he is about to undertake. Then, once dawn comes, the Imam al-Mahdi will take up his position between two locations in the courtyard of the Kaaba, the Maqam Ibrahim,
Maqam Ibrahim is, of course, literally the place where Ibrahim stood. That is the place where Ibrahim, during his own sojourn in Mecca, stood in order to pray. And this, of course, is marked in the courtyard of Kaaba even now. As for the Rukn al-Yamani, this is the corner of the Kaaba. The southwest corner of the Kaaba. The corner pointing in the direction of Yemen, hence the designation of Yamani, Rukn al-Yamani.
To stand at Maqam Ibrahim and to offer a prayer is, of course, a part of the Hajj ritual. But in this particular case, that is the re-emergence of the 12th Imam, one may deduce some further symbolic significance, namely that he is hereby connecting himself implicitly to the entire line of prophets, reaching back from his own ancestor, the Prophet Muhammad, to Ibrahim himself. However, he stands not at the Maqam Ibrahim, but between that and the corner of the Kaaba, one of the corners of the Kaaba. And this may indicate a connection with all of the bearers of the Divine Word, even before Ibrahim, even before Abraham. Why? Because, in Islamic belief, the first builder of the Kaaba was none other than Adam himself. So, by positioning himself here, the Imam al-Mahdi is connecting himself spatially, symbolically, over the entire line of prophets and the entirety of sacred history. Taking up his position there, he makes his proclamation: O chiefs and people who are close to me, O you who are preserved on earth by Allah in order to help me, come towards me and obey me. O chiefs and people who are close to me, O you who are preserved on earth, by Allah, in order to help me, come towards me and obey me. The chiefs and the people who are close to me. This presumably refers to those faithful Shia who heard the otherwise inaudible proclamation made on the previous 23rd of Ramadan. Having heard that, they would know that on the following Ashura, the Imam would become manifest again and presumably have come there to him to be at his disposal when he made the proclamation. It is said that there will be precisely 313 of them, 50 of them women. Why 313? Here again an echo of previous history, although now of exclusively Islamic history, because this is the number of people who fought with the Prophet at the Battle of Badr.
Which was, of course, the first battle fought in Islam. The Battle of Badr, there were 313 people. So no need to expatiate on the significance of this. An obvious echo or a replay of earlier history. One can say that the final confrontation of truth with untruth is a mirror, numerically speaking, of that first confrontation that took place in the Battle of Badr. In response to this proclamation of the Imam, O chiefs and people who are close to me, the 313 will advance towards him to pledge their allegiance to him. And pillars of light will rise up from the courtyard of the Kaaba to the heavens. And these pillars of light will make visible to the naked eye, to the physical eye, heavenly entities, such as the divine throne, and the tablet, what the Quran refers to as the preserved tablet, on which the archetype of all revelation is inscribed. This is interesting in that the light rises up to the heavens. It does not come down from the heavens, as might be expected. In other words, the Imam himself, or his re-emergence, is the supreme manifestation of the divine luminosity, of the divine light, such as it is his light that illumines the heavens and makes visible that which is otherwise belongs to the hidden, the non-manifest realm, the throne, the divine throne, and the preserved tablet. We also find here a possible parallel with one element in the narrative concerning the birth of the Prophet. Although it is not something that can be authenticated with reference to the Quran, it is often said in the relevant narratives concerning the Prophet, both Sunni and Shi'i sources, that his birth also was accompanied by columns of light rising up from the earth to the heavens. After the receipt of allegiance from the 313, the Imam goes towards the Kaaba and sits, places his back against it, stretches out his hand and invites a pledge of allegiance from all others who are present on this occasion. In other words, not simply his own 313 followers, but all others who happen to be present there. As he does this, light will come forth from his outstretched hand, note again this element of luminosity, and he will say, "This is the hand of God. It is from his direction and through his command. This is the hand of God. It is from his direction and through his command." And he will then recite verse 10 of chapter 48 of the Quran, which reads, "Certainly those who swear allegiance to you, they swear allegiance to God. And the hand of God is above their hands." An explanation, let me begin with this verse. The verse, of course, is originally addressed to the Prophet. "Those who swear allegiance to you,
swear allegiance to God. Why? Because it is axiomatic, and the Quran stresses this on several occasions, that obedience to the Prophet is coterminous with obedience to God. Therefore, to swear allegiance to the Prophet is swearing allegiance to God. And as for the other expression, the hand of God is above their hand, obviously not to be taken in an anthropomorphic sense, that God has a hand akin to the hand of humans, but rather that his authority is above their hand. In other words, his authority confirms the pledge of allegiance that has been made by the believers who place their hands in the hand of the Prophet as the outward sign of swearing allegiance to him. Now, the fact that the Imam at this point recites this verse is of obvious significance. Again, it is, as it were, a reflection, a continuation of the authority of the Prophet. So when he, at the beginning of this sentence, says, "This is the hand of God," clearly it is not a claim to being divine manifestation. It is his own hand. However, in a symbolic and a functional sense, it is the hand of God. To place one's hand in the hand of the Imam and to swear allegiance to him is swearing allegiance to God. One other detail in this portion of the narrative, the fact that the Imam places his back against the Kaaba. This might appear to be an act of gross discourtesy towards the Kaaba. Isn't the Kaaba, it's not only the house of mankind, it is the house of Allah. It is the earthly counterpart of the divine throne, and to turn one's back to it, and to go beyond that, and in fact to lean against it, or might be seen to be, an act of supreme discourtesy and even impiety. And in fact, no one in his right mind would attempt to do this in the course of the pilgrimage today. And even there are those who believe that it is not permissible to turn one's back to the Kaaba even when exiting from the courtyard surrounding it, if people backing out, as if from the presence of the revered personage. So how then do we explain or understand what in other than the Imam, other than Imam Mahdi, would be a highly reprehensible act? The explanation that follows is a tentative one. I cannot claim to have seen it in any particular source, but if one correlates it with certain other beliefs and traditions, possibly it makes sense. Anyway, I'll just regard this as a suggestion, not something representing Shia or Islamic tradition in general. There is the hadith, which is to be found in both Sunni and Shia sources, in which God says, speaking on the tongue of the Prophet, "The heavens and the earth cannot contain me, rather the heart of my believing servant contains me." The heavens and the earth cannot contain me, rather the heart of my believing servant contains me. And from this it has been deduced, not surprisingly, by the Sufis above all, that the true house of God in this world is not the Kaaba, not a structure made of mortar and bricks, but rather the heart of the believer. So the purified heart of the believer as a locus for the divine presence is ultimately superior to the Kaaba. And this is expressed in numerous ways, particularly in the sphere of Sufism. If it be permissible to transfer this to the person of the Mahdi, his leaning against the Kaaba may possibly be understood in this sense. In other words, he, as indeed the purified servant of God, and more than that, has a superiority over the Kaaba itself. So that this act of apparent discourtesy becomes comprehensible and justifiable. Having invited this pledge of allegiance from all those present, it is said that other orders of being now come forward to pledge in their allegiance. The angels, the totality of the angels, first we saw Michael and Gabriel, are coming to him at night, now the totality of the angels, and then the most noble among the jinn.
I don't want to go into a lengthy discussion of the topic of who and what are the jinn. Enough to say that the jinn are a category mentioned in the Quran
of subtle being, in other words, under normal circumstances to most people, not visible or noticeable. And in fact, the word jinn comes from an Arabic root meaning hidden. So they are those whose existence is hidden, although nonetheless real. Because it is not, reality is obviously not exhausted by what is materially visible to us. In any event, the jinn have in common with humans the possession of free will. And therefore they may either believe or refuse belief. They may be either virtuous or evil. And the virtuous and the believers among them at this point come forward to pledge their allegiance to the Mahdi. What are we to make of this? I think two things. Firstly, that the cosmic functions of the Imam go even beyond the human sphere. So that other orders of being, other orders of subtle being, the angels and the jinn, also acknowledge his claims of authority over them. And secondly, again, an echo of an element, an incident in the life of the Prophet. He also received a profession of belief from some of the jinn when he was in the environs of the city of Taif in Arabia. After receiving the allegiance of the angels, the jinn, and the 313 faithful followers, some of the other people will also come forward. It is said that from all of the people of Mecca, only four people at this point will pledge their allegiance to the Imam. And of all of the people of Medina, only four. So from these two most sacred cities in Islam, Mecca and Medina, only eight will step forward to pledge their allegiance to the Imam. They will in fact be confused, not surprisingly, by what is underway, because they will not recognize any of the 313 people. 313 faithful followers of the Imam will be unknown to them. Why? Because they have gathered there from outside the Haramain, from outside Mecca and Medina, in order to pledge their allegiance to the Imam and to lend him their aid. Once the sun has fully risen, there will be another declaration, this time from the heavens, and this time audible to everyone. The first heavenly proclamation, remember, on the preceding 23rd of Ramadan, was audible only to the faithful followers of the Imam. This one will be generally audible, not only to the Muslims, but in fact to all of mankind. Across the world, as I said, the voice will be audible. And appropriately, the proclamation begins, O people of the worlds, O people of the worlds. Note here the plural, by the way, worlds, which means not only the human world, but all levels and orders of being. They are addressed. This is the Mahdi from among the descendants of Muhammad. This is the Mahdi from among the descendants of Muhammad. So a generally audible proclamation to the entirety of mankind announcing the coming of the Mahdi from the lineage of the Prophet. In the traditions, the question of language and the diversity of language is not made apparent. Is not touched upon. But once one posits the possibility of what is clearly a miraculous event, then one can go logically one step further and say that irrespective of the language of those who hear this address, it will presumably be comprehensible to them. The believers, having heard this proclamation, will then say, we hear and we obey. We hear and we obey. سمعنا وأطعنا. Now, at exactly the same time, or very soon thereafter, another voice will appear, will be audible, coming from the west. And this voice will say the following: a Sufyani has appeared in Palestine. A Sufyani has appeared in Palestine. Pay allegiance to him in order to be saved.
In other words, the rival claim to the allegiance and the loyalty of the believers now makes of his appearance. Who is the Sufyani? Sufyani is of course taken from the name Abu Sufyan, the father of Muawiyah, and therefore the grandfather of Yazid. Abu Sufyan, in the lifetime of the Prophet, was one of the most obstinate opponents of Islam, embraced Islam only after the conquest of Mecca and the return there of the Prophet Muawiyah and Yazid, of course, we have discussed it in detail. So a Sufyani is a descendant of Yazid, a member of the Umayyad family. And now a proclamation is made of his appearance and of his claim to allegiance. So very obviously there is here some kind of replay, repetition, reflection of early Shi'i history. It is said that the first time this proclamation is made, no one in Mecca will listen to him. However, the second time that the proclamation is made, some people will defect and join the cause of the Sufyani. What is the logic behind this? Again, without attempting to judge one way or the other, the literal veracity of the traditions, that if the cause of the imamate is the cause not simply of a given lineage, but the cause of justice, legitimate rule, obedience to God, then it makes sense that at the very end of history, this principle should be confronted with its negative counterpart. Therefore, Sufyani, as the heir of Yazid, makes his appearance. In other words, there is the necessity in this final confrontation for a manifestation of absolute evil as well. And as we shall see, this manifestation of absolute evil is twofold. It is not simply of a Sufyani, but also the Antichrist, the Dajjal, who I mentioned last couple of sessions ago in a different context. And we'll come to the Dajjal, what he does and how he is defeated, in a minute. There is the emergence, while the Imam Mahdi is still in Mecca, of the Sufyani. The Imam Mahdi continues with his task by making another proclamation that he is identical with all of the preceding prophets and imams. He says that truly anyone who wishes to see Adam and Seth should know that I am Adam and Seth. Whoever wishes to see Noah and Shem should know that I am Noah and Shem, and so on. Why the mention not only of these prophets, Adam and Noah, but also of their sons? Because Shia belief sees in earlier sacred history the counterpart to the imamate. In other words, each of the preceding prophets is held in turn to have had his succession of authorized successors, imams, like
imams comparable to the imams following on the Prophet Muhammad. And like in just the same way that the imams of the Prophet are from his lineage, likewise, the successors of the earlier prophets are held to be from their respective lineages. So another identification on the part of the Imam Mahdi now returns with the totality of preceding history. And then he says, anyone who has read all of the divine scriptures and scrolls, let them now hear them from me. Anyone who has read the divine scriptures and scrolls, let them now hear them from me. And he proceeds to recite all of the sacred books and revelations of history, restoring them to their integral and collect form. Since it is the Islamic belief that previous scriptures were, whether by accident, because of the ravages of time or because of deliberate distortion, subject to textual change and loss. And now the Imam, as part of his general function as a kind of a recapitulation of sacred history as a whole, he will recite in their original and integral form the text of all preceding revelations. Now we come to the difficult and in fact controversial point, controversial even within Shi'ism itself, of what is called the Raja'ah. Raja'ah,
what you might call the partial or selective resurrection of certain individuals in advance of the general resurrection. We are dealing here, obviously, with something different from the reappearance of the Imam.
Let's clarify that with some emphasis. The Imam returns from occultation to the human plane, to visibility.
Raja'ah is something different. Those who are dead are now brought back. The word Raja'ah, of course, means return.
They're brought back by means of resurrection, but in advance of the general resurrection of mankind. They're not yet at Qiyamah.
The persons that are brought back are marked either by great virtue, exceeding virtue, or profound corruption. So this general theme, which underlies the whole of this narrative, of a decisive confrontation between the forces of evil and virtue, unbelief and belief, injustice and justice, again finds expression here. Among those who return at this point are, for example, Imam Hussein and his 72 companions, the 72 that kept faith with him and once martyred together with him at Karbala, and other of the Imams also, as well as some of the companions of the Prophet. The problematic nature of this belief is that although the Mahdi has returned from a state of occultation to the manifest plane, obviously he has not died. Obviously, from the point of view of the premises we have established, whereas these individuals have indeed died and are now being brought back in advance of the general resurrection. In defense of this belief, the following arguments, the following scriptural arguments have been advanced. Firstly, verse 11 of chapter 40 of the Quran, which cites the sinners as saying on the Day of Judgment, O our Lord, you have caused us to die twice and brought us back to life twice. You have caused us to die twice and brought us back to life twice. There are, of course, a multitude of possible interpretations for this, but if one wishes to adduce it in favor of the doctrine of Raja'ah, then it would seem to be fairly clear and explicit. Being killed, being caused to die twice and brought back to life twice. So that just the same way that the person is resurrected in advance of the general resurrection, likewise he will be caused to die again and then be resurrected again. So two deaths, two resurrections. And then, of course, we have the Qur'anic belief that Jesus, among his other miracles, also resurrected the dead. This is based, among other things, on verse 49 of chapter 3 of the Qur'an. And it is argued that if Jesus, as a prophet, was capable of resurrecting the dead, obviously in advance of the general universal resurrection of mankind, then certainly it should be possible for God to do so also. So on a scriptural and even rational basis, an argument is made in favor of the Rajah. Against argument, against the theory or the belief of the doctrine of Rajah, it can be said, in fact has been said, that among those who will be, as it were, selectively resurrected will be the Prophet himself. But he plays no significant role in the unfolding of the narrative surrounding the return of the 12th Imam. This being the case, the concept itself becomes, in the view of certain scholars, questionable. Because all that the 12th Imam does is ultimately, as the one who fulfills the will, who has inherited the legacy, the mission, the scripture of the Prophet, and that he should, as it were, put it bluntly, be sidelined in this last and final confrontation of history seems questionable. In any event, this is the belief in the Rajah. After the receipt of allegiance, the Imam Mahdi goes from Mecca to Medina. In the sense that this is pretty obvious, this is, as it were, a replay, an echo of the Hijra, the original migration of the Prophet from Mecca to Medina, and also a movement to the seat of authority. Medina was, of course, the first seat of Islamic government. And the Mahdi is here, above all, for governmental purposes. He establishes a government. Once arrived in Mecca, he rebuilds the... Before he leaves Mecca to go to Medina, he rebuilds the Kaaba. He rebuilds the Kaaba exactly as it was in the time of Adam. He rebuilds the Kaaba exactly as it was in the time of Adam. I've already mentioned the belief that the Kaaba was first built by Adam. And of course, in the course of time, it has been destroyed, rebuilt on numerous occasions. Although the black stone in the corner of the Kaaba, one of the corners of the Kaaba, is held to be a relic of the first destruction made by Adam. Again, one can see behind or together with this narrative detail, a symbolic aspect, namely a reconstruction, a final reconstruction or restoration of that which the Kaaba symbolizes, namely the divine unity. And it may be also appropriate to recall that even before the beginning of his mission, the Prophet had a hand in the reconstruction of the Kaaba in his own time. The Kaaba was being rebuilt, and it was the Prophet, even before the beginning of his mission, who was chosen for the significant task of placing the black stone in the corner of the Kaaba. Also, before leaving Mecca to go to Medina, the Imam al-Mahdi will destroy the palaces built by the caliphs. He will destroy the palaces built by the caliphs and by the unjust rulers. And here again, obviously, the purpose is more than material. It is to destroy the architectural manifestations of shirk. In just the same way that the restoration of the Kaaba to its original form has the symbolic sense of restoring the correct and true understanding of divine unity, likewise destroying the palaces built by the caliphs is the destruction of the outer, sort of the architectural manifestations of the negative counterpart of Tohi, which is Shirk. Of course, one should not take this in a restrictive sense. Not only the palaces built by the caliphs, no doubt the palaces built by the Saudis also. There was a large royal palace built on one of the hillsides directly overlooking the Kaaba. So this is obviously a prime target for destruction by the Mahdi, if it's still standing at that time. Not to mention the Mecca Hilton. Might also be on the list of demolition. Now, after the Imam has left Mecca for Medina, the revolt will take place in Mecca. And the deputy that he has left behind to rule on his behalf will be killed. I cannot discover here either a historical echo or a symbolic aspect of this part of the narrative. In any event, it is said that the Imam will send an army from Medina to Mecca to suppress the rebellion. Those who took part in the rebellion repent and will be forgiven. However, then they rebel again, and this time they are not forgiven. And the killing of all of those who have rebelled against the authority of the Mahdi takes place. Then from Medina, the Imam Mahdi moves to Kufa, which was, of course, the seat of government of Imam Ali, so that here he is engaged in a restoration of the government of Imam Ali. And at this time, a movement arises in easterly regions which will strengthen his government. There are two locations mentioned here. Iranians among you will be happy to hear in Iran. From two places in Iran, groups of people will arise in order to lend their support to the Mahdi.
These two locations are Zeylan. Zeylan, I think I talked about before, this is now an arcane geographical term. It corresponds roughly to the present-day province of Gilan, that area on the Caspian shore, which, since its first acquaintance with Islam, professed Shiism. Talakhan is a city in Khorasan, in the eastern part of Iran, which now has no particular significance, although at an earlier point in history it was also one of the early strongholds of Shiism in Iran. There are, of course, more than one place
called Talakhan. There was also a Talakhan in northeastern Afghanistan. So if anyone would like to press the claims of the Taliban in Afghanistan, I guess the way is open. The significant point is that these two locations, Zeylan and Talakhan, obviously have their significance in the earlier history of Shiism. It is said that a descendant, now we're back to the scenario surrounding the reemergence of the Mahdi, it is said that a descendant of Imam Hassan, the second Imam, will emerge in Zeylan, and that he will call upon the devotees of the Imam to gather around him and to proceed to Kufa in order to give support to the Mahdi. The most significant response will come precisely from Talakhan, from this city the eastern part of Iran. And then this army, drawn from these two areas, will come westwards to Kufa, defeating the enemies of the Imam as they come. And once they arrive in Kufa, then they form, as it were, the core of the military force that the Mahdi is now gathering. And he will display to them, as tokens of the Imamate, the weapons which, according to a tradition already established by Ja'far al-Sadiq, were in the hereditary possession of the Imams, weapons used by the Prophet, and therefore indicating his authority, his political and military authority. Some of this force, arriving from Iran, is now sent to Damascus in order to capture and put to death the Sufyani. This they are successful in doing, they behead the Sufyani and send his head back to Kufa. Here, obviously, there is a reversal or a mirror image of what happened at Karbala. On the occasion of Karbala, of course, an army came from Damascus, killed Imam Hussein, and took his head back to Damascus. Whereas what happens now is that an army goes from Iraq to Damascus, puts to death the descendant of Yazid, Sufyani, beheads him and brings his head back to Kufa. So, in obvious narrative terms, a reversal of earlier history. I will break off at this point and inshallah conclude the narrative next time. Thank you.